Good morning. Wow. Good morning to a lot of you. And hello to those of you online. It's good to see all your faces. All your faces. This morning, we're going to continue our series on the Beatitudes. And if you read if you're reading the title, I guess the slide's up there. No, it's not. There it is. You already know that this week it's blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Now, I'm guessing like many or most of you, I've walked this journey of faith for a good long time, although I've probably walked it longer than most of you. And somewhere along the way, for me maybe 10, 15 years ago, I began to feel like my faith was a shoe that didn't quite fit correctly. And I found myself questioning things that I'd assumed to be correct for decades, and wondering if either I'd missed something or if there might be something more. And that began what I guess is called a period of reconstruction or deconstruction. Now, for some, deconstruction is a very disorienting process. I was lucky because I was just beginning a 2-year program in spiritual formation and spiritual direction. So I was surrounded by others who were farther along on their faith journey than I, who could help me through my process and my questions. So it was a little gentle for me. But that being said, I realized for lo those many years, I'd spent a lot of time carefully constructing a box to contain the Almighty God in, with the idea that I had a handle on understanding God and felt that I pretty much knew what's what in terms of faith. In fact, I was pretty certain of it, until I wasn't. So I began to slowly and sometimes reluctantly deconstruct the walls of that box to see what God might actually be like, and to begin with the grapple of a mystery that I could embrace. Recognizing that there's a good part of this whole faith thing, God in particular, that I will never completely understand. And over the years, that has become more and more okay with me. However, I still had this idea of having completed something, so that now that I was on the right path, or so it seemed to me, the past teachings from others, and sadly from myself, still had an effect on me. And it lurked around in the background of my faith operating system, as it were. I sort of thought that having deconstructed, I could check that off my box, land on something that I was sure of, and be done with it. But no. Part of the beauty of the deconstruction process is that it makes room for more growth, and is a continuing process of letting go, making room, and opening to possibilities. The faith journey becomes something like a bud of a flower. There is an unfolding of sorts, where things I've assumed forever take on new possibilities, new meanings, and lead to new discoveries. And so it is with the Beatitudes. I think I mentioned last time I spoke that for most of my life, the Beatitudes were not really a friend of mine. And for a long time, even after my D or reconstruction, I still hadn't looked at them very carefully, partly because there was a lot of other cool stuff that was opening and becoming new to me. And I was having fun absorbing that. So I hadn't quite got to the Beatitudes yet. But then I have a friend, Larry Warner, who wrote this book. In fact, it's the book that we're using as a baseline for our series. It's called The Beatitudes of Jesus, An Invitation to the Sacred Space of De-Reconstruction. And because I occasionally see Larry Warner, I felt like I should read it in case he mentioned it to me. Because he's used me at times to read chapters of other books, and he wants to know what I thought. So I thought, I should read this. But this one hooked me. And it really changed my relationship with not only the Beatitudes, but with the Sermon on the Mount. Suddenly, rather than platitudes that were stuck on the fridge, or worse, an oppressive to-do-or-you-don't-get-to-heaven list, They became beautiful open-ended invitations. Invitations to grow and to learn things about the kingdom, and words themselves seem to be active and breathing. And that's kind of a biblical thought. So I've enjoyed listening to our other teachers' perspectives, and each week I find myself discovering new things about this familiar passage. We each take Larry Warner's book as a baseline, but then we infuse our own personalities and experiences into it, and it is like that flower that keeps blossoming. Hopefully you've enjoyed it as well. Well, this week as I worked on my message, I discovered that I think, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy," is actually backwards. But we'll get to that in a minute. "Blessed are the merciful" is smack dab in the middle of the nine Beatitudes. And in a way, it connects them all together. And it's closely tied to the first Beatitude, or maybe I just think about that because that was the last one I preached on, which was "Blessed are the poor in spirit," where we are invited to own our limitations and shortcomings and open ourselves to God and his resources, of which mercy is front and center. Robert Gulich, in the Sermon on the Mount, A Foundation for Understanding, describes it as this: "Those who reflect God's acceptance of the unworthy, the guilty, and the ones in the wrong, because the merciful themselves, conscious of their own unworthiness, guilt, and wrong, have experienced God's forgiving and restoring acceptance through the message of Jesus Christ. In other words, we are only able to truly and fully be merciful because of our awareness of the mercy we are already receiving from God. I think we've all heard the definition of mercy and its twin sister, grace. Mercy is not getting what you do deserve, and grace is getting what you do not deserve. Well, both of these statements are true, but according to Larry Warner, they would be equally true if reversed. Jesus seems to teach that mercy is not getting what you do deserve and getting what you do not deserve. In fact, Jesus' entire message could be summed up as mercy, grace, compassion, and love, none of which are deserved by any of us, but all of which are given freely. Love. Happy Valentine's Day, by the way. A day late, but happy. Love is an important element here. It's easy to act mercifully out of a wrong motivation, isn't it? A motivation rooted in superiority, spreading your mercy and your largesse to the poor and the downtrodden souls who are inferior to us. But you know what? That isn't mercy. That's condescension. The mercy we're talking about here is quite different. The mercy Jesus exhibited was one steeped in love and empathy, seeking to understand another's position and what it must be like to be there. Let's take a look at Philippians 2, 6 through 11. Jesus, who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. This puts a really different spin on the incarnation, God with us. Why did he do it? To become one with us and to embody empathy. Seeking to understand another's position and what it must be like to be there. In other words, Jesus put flesh on this Old Testament passage. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his mercies never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. That's Lamentations 3, 22 and 23. This verse indicates that there are three elements to mercy. There's probably more, but there's three in this verse. It's creative, it's consistent, and it's dynamic, as it changes and adapts to to our situations. The mercy of God is appropriate to each day and each circumstance. It is enduring, persistent, powerful, and abundant, and best, freely given. Let's look at a couple of portraits of mercy from Jesus' teachings. And I'm sure you're familiar with these. The first is found in the parable of the unmerciful servant. Here a king was settling accounts with one of his servants who owed him a great deal of money. The servant was unable to pay, and the king ordered that he and his family and all of his possessions be sold to repay the debt. But the servant begged his master to have pity and be patient, and he would repay the debt in time. The servant's master had mercy on him, canceling the debt, letting him go. However, the servant immediately went to one who owed him a fraction of what he owed his master and refused to take pity on him. The king found out about it and angrily told the servant, "Hey, I canceled all the debt of yours because you asked. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" Well, the takeaway here is one who has been given mercy should, out of a grateful heart, grant mercy to others. Pay it forward, as it were. Second snapshot is the parable of the Good Samaritan. We're probably all familiar with it. A man was attacked by robbers and lay half dead in a ditch. A priest and later a Levite walked past him without lending assistance. Finally, a Samaritan happened by and saw the man, had mercy on him, bandaged his wounds, and took him to an inn where he gave the innkeeper money for his upkeep. And he even said he would return later to give more money if it were owed. He would reimburse the innkeeper for any extra expense. Now, I'm going to stop here, put a pause in that story, and I have to tell you a funny story of our own. One Saturday evening about a week ago, Ben and I were in Woodland Hills at the Kaiser facility. And on our way out, we noticed a woman lying in a sidewalk in a parking lot, and a Jewish man was standing beside her. From his clothing, he was obviously Orthodox, and it is against the Orthodox tradition for a man to touch a woman who is not his wife. Yet we could see from his face that he was wanting to help her, even though it was the Sabbath. She had hit her head and thought her knee might be broken. We offered to assist, and Ben said we ought to get a wheelchair so we could get her across the parking lot into ER. Suddenly, the Orthodox gentleman brightened up and he said, "I can get the wheelchair." He looked so relieved that he could actually help in some way without going against the rules of his faith. Once the wheelchair was procured, we thanked him and told him that we could take it from here, and he looked so relieved. He really did. He thanked us profusely. And we took the woman to the ER. We checked her in, lent her my phone so she could call her husband. We got her an ice bag for her knee. And in the midst of it, we found out that she'd just lost her home in the Palisades fire. Yeah. So we were able to offer her some comfort, both physical and emotional, for the pain she was in. It was one of those holy moments that happens sometimes. But on the way home, knowing that I was going to preach about mercy, we sort of laughed about being the Good Samaritan. But I said that I thought we were almost there more for the poor Jewish gentleman who was in such a quandary. He wanted so badly to help and still wanted to uphold the traditions of his faith that he held so dear, and he didn't know what to do. So I think we were there for him. But I digress. Back to the real Good Samaritan. So Jesus, after telling the parable of the Good Samaritan, asked which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, was a neighbor to the man who was injured. The expert in Jewish law replied begrudgingly, because the Samaritans were not friends of the Jews, to say the least, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." So our takeaway here is that we should extend mercy as it is called for, even when inconvenient and costly. Our last example is found in Matthew 25. Jesus instructs those who are listening, who might include us, to love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. He further says, if you only love those who love you, what good is that? Even the ungodly do that, but rather, love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. One thing is clear from these passages. We who have received and are receiving mercy are to demonstrate mercy to others. Mercy is meant to exist in a continuous flow. As much as God is pouring out, we are to extend it out just as liberally. As Larry Warner puts it, mercy is to be freely flowing from within us out toward the marginalized, the outcast, the struggling, the imprisoned, the poor, the oppressed, the least of these, as well as our neighbors on the freeways, in the coffee shop, or in the grocery store, our friends and our enemies alike. 1 John 4:19 states, we love because God first loved us. The teachings of Jesus clearly show that those who have received mercy are those who are to give mercy to others. Mercy is, in a sense, the public face of love. Now, I have been known to reword scripture now and then, and thus far I've not been struck down by lightning, which I am extremely grateful for God's mercy. But I was so happy to discover that I have a kindred spirit in Larry Warner, because he does it too. And here's his rewording of that 1 John passage. We show mercy because God first showed mercy to us. Whoever claims to receive mercy from God, yet does not show mercy to his brother or sister, is a liar. And God has given us this command. Anyone who loves me and receives mercy from me must also show mercy to their sister or brother. And we know, don't we, that sister and brother extends far beyond our natural sisters and brothers, or even, as we said in the 80s, our brothers and sisters in the Lord. But that brings up a sticky point. It is not difficult extending mercy to those we love, or those we like, or even those we don't know at all. That sort of comes naturally, doesn't it? But what about the jerks that cut us off on the freeway? Or those in the express lane in the grocery store with a cart full of groceries and a handful of coupons? What about the boss who passed you over for promotion yet once again? Or the sister who gets on our last nerve every single holiday? Or the next door neighbor whose dog poops on your lawn? And the neighbor who goes, oh, sorry, and keeps walking? Or the guy who works on his motorcycle underneath your bedroom window at 7:30 a.m. every Saturday morning? What about that guy? What about the guy we didn't vote for but somehow made it to office and is making decisions that we find unconscionable? Now, folks, I don't want to poke fingers at one side of the aisle or the other, because if you like the guy in the White House, you don't like the guy in charge of California, and vice versa. So I'm speaking to everyone here. What about them? I wish I had an easy answer for you, but sadly, there's no asterisk next to the mercy verses that says these folks are exempt from the mercy mandate. So how can we extend mercy to them and still look ourselves in the face? First of all, extending mercy doesn't mean we have to agree with folks or approve of their behavior. It doesn't mean we need to support them when they do things that are damaging to others. It doesn't mean we can't ask the neighbor to pick up the dog poop. Doesn't mean that at all. But mercy's kind of a funny thing, because withholding mercy is sort of like withholding a grudge, like refusing to forgive. It doesn't hurt the one it's intended to punish. In fact, when we do that, we're the ones who suffer. Withholding mercy is toxic, not to the person from whom mercy is withheld, but to the withholder. In other words, to you. There's a wise saying, and I would cite the source, but according to Google, it's attributed to several people. I guess you hear a good thing and you stamp your name on it. So I don't know who said it. But someone said, unforgiveness is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. And I think for those of us who have struggled with dealing with mercy lately towards some of our maybe elected officials, we felt that toxicity in the form of depression, in anger, in sickness. I think we can safely say withholding mercy is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. They're two sides of the same coin. When we withhold mercy, it's rejecting the Christ in that person, no matter how deeply buried, no matter how seemingly invisible it may be. Because one thing I am sure of, it is there inside them, just like it is inside us. Do we take time to look for it? And if we can't find it, do we take time to mourn for that person and for our own ability to see beyond ourselves? Now, I want to take us through an exercise, and it won't be comfortable, I can promise you. But then what's the point of it if it's fun, right? That's what we have game day for. Think of someone who, whenever they come to your mind, your blood begins to boil. Now, for many of you, that may be a real simple thing. Someone who represents everything you stand against. Someone whose very name is like fingernails on a blackboard of your soul. Have you thought of someone? I bet you have. Now let's take a moment to acknowledge the knot in your stomach as this person is brought to mind. And let's take a few deep breaths together. And as you're breathing, recognize that you're safe here. That God is with you. God is for you. Take a couple more deep breaths, just for good measure. Now, with this person in mind, have you ever stopped to wonder what on earth makes this person act the way they do? What trauma might have occurred to cause them to create a shell of bitterness and anger? Or a grasping for acceptance and love that was withheld by those who should have loved them? What might have caused such damage that they seem to have renounced any semblance of decency or humanity? What must have happened to them? Can you imagine that person as a small child and see the longings of that child as they're going unmet? Now, I tried to find a picture of one such person as a baby, as a child. And I decided not to use it because I found a picture of this person as a four-year-old. And you could already see the damage that had been done in that portrait. And it breaks your heart. So I decided not to use it. Can you imagine that child hardening their heart, convincing themselves that it doesn't matter, and at some point their sad little life, they stand with their fist clenched in the air like Scarlett O'Hara from Gone with the Wind, and they say, I'm going to live through this, and when it's over, I'm never going to hurt like this again. No, not any of my folks. If I have to kill or steal, as God is my witness, I will never hurt like this again. And they close off their own capacity to hurt and to love, to show mercy, or do anything other than oppress and dominate and when. That's sad. That's tragic. Not everyone who experiences extreme hurt or trauma pays it forward to others. Not everyone who experiences pain or suffering becomes an insensitive, destructive bully. Some wounded folks seek help and are able to rise above the pain of their past. Those are heroes in my book. But then there are the other ones. And the thought of extending mercy to them is difficult, impossible, to put it mildly. Jeremy Kintzer spoke last week on using our imagination to ask God to give us new eyes to see what could be or could have been, to imagine a world where brokenness doesn't break us. Can we take that and apply it to those who seemingly are not worthy of our mercy? Can we imagine, with a lot of God's help, to see what they could have been had circumstances not worked together to break their hearts and their souls? I have a very strong-minded daughter. I could tell from the time she was two that she was going to be a force of nature. And I remember telling her somewhere in her elementary school years, you have a great power of leadership and a strong personality, and you can choose which direction you want to lead. Fortunately, she chose wisely, but some don't. When you think of that person who came to mind, can you imagine a time when our own hearts may melt with compassion towards them, so that their brokenness does not break us? Perhaps your heart is welling up with resistance right now. Mine did when I was writing this, honestly. Perhaps your heart cries out for justice. But remember what Jeremy said about justice last week. Mishpat in the Hebrew, it's restorative, not retributive. Retributive. That's not really a word, actually. I looked it up. So if I'm mispronouncing it, I think it doesn't matter. Because you get the concept. James 2:13 underscores this triumph. Mercy triumphs over judgment. So even if we can manage to find compassion and mercy, how do we hold those at the same time that we're morally outraged at what the same person is doing or saying or being? When this person's unmerciful, unloving behavior is also new every morning. Can we extend mercy at the same time we are actively resisting what that person is doing in us and others? I believe we can. I believe there is a way to hold healthy boundaries, to stand against injustice without nursing anger and bitterness that might even cause our activism to become less effective. Bryan Stevenson stated in Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, there is a strength, a power even, in understanding brokenness, because embracing our brokenness creates a need and desire for mercy, and perhaps a corresponding need to show mercy. When you are experiencing mercy, you learn things that are hard to learn otherwise. You see things you can't otherwise see. You hear things you can't otherwise hear. You begin to recognize the humanity that resides in every single one of us. Showing mercy opens up new possibilities. Now, I'm going to tell you a personal story, and I am hoping that you understand that I have changed or softened many of my opinions since between 1975, when this incident happened, and today. Almost 50 years of aging and maturing will tend to do that. But I think the story can speak to us today, so I'm trusting you with it. And if you have questions, we've got the conversation after the service. We can talk about it there. There's a game that goes around, and it's called I Listen, But I Do Not Judge. And I'm asking that you would extend that to me this morning. So back in the 1970s, I was ensconced in the center of the evangelical bubble. I had strong feelings of certainty, and I was pretty much sure that God agreed with me. Now, you can laugh. That's sort of tragically funny now, but at the moment, that felt right. And at that time, I think because I'm an adopted child, and had I been conceived today, I likely would have been aborted. I had some rather strong personal feelings about abortion. And for a while, I wrote for the Right to Life League. Now, this is prior to the time where they started bombing abortion clinics, I need to say. The pattern was, I would meet with a speaker, get a rough outline of what they wanted to communicate, and then I would put words to it. Then I would give it back to them for revisions. It would go back and forth and back and forth a couple of times, and then it was ready for the podium. Well, one particular speaker was a little bit more fiery than some of the others that I normally worked with. But somehow she and I met, and she gave me an outline of what she wanted to say. And I softened it up and wrote something that seemed right and returned it to her. And she passed it back, having made notes, many notes, in red and bold, underlined, with some circles and arrows, and sent it back to me. And to my horror, she had turned my speech into one that was full of vitriol and hate, pointed specifically at some communities whose expression of love were different than hers. She had added in name-calling, coarse, vile name-calling, and it was sickening to me. After some soul-searching, I called her, and I said, "You're not authorized to use any of the words or any part of my speech or my name." And I resigned on the spot, saying that even though at the time I might agree with some of the things, I couldn't countenance being part of a group that got their point across through hate while simultaneously invoking the name of God. Well, that was my attempt at activism. But it opened doors to mercy. The conversation stuck with me, and it caused me to think a bit, because in my better moments, I do that. And I thought, no matter what thoughts I may or may not have about abortion personally, I'm not facing it. And I wondered what it would have been like for my 15-year-old mother in the early 50s. And I was flooded with mercy and compassion for her and for those like her who were facing decisions that were brutal and difficult to make. At the same time, I wondered how that speaker had moved from a stated compassion for the unborn child to a blind hate for those who found themselves facing the unwanted pregnancy or unready for pregnancy, or for those who thought differently than she did. Now, I found out later, interestingly, that she had had an abortion as a teenager. And I am willing to bet that her anger and hate were towards herself due to unresolved grief and an inability to grapple with the decision that she had made herself. I don't know, but it's possible. The question is, could it be possible to extend mercy rather than judgment? And as I was busy judging her for her hate, what about that? Could it be possible to approach the issues and the person with the love exemplified by Christ? Could I have done it differently and maybe remained a voice in her head? I don't know. Wondering how many young girls might have been helped rather than vilified if the Right to Life League had handled things differently. What if they and their sister organizations put their time and energy and resources into helping the girls and into education for young people in general? How might things have changed for the better? how many lives, unborn and pregnant, might have been saved. Mercy triumphs over judgment. That was the seed of mercy beginning to emerge in me. And over time, I believe God watered that seed, showing me a broader perspective than I had held to that point. Okay, that was sort of heavy, so let's take another breath. I'm going to. Maybe a drink of water. Well, like I said, I've changed a lot, and many of my black and white opinions in time have shifted to a rather lovely shade of dove gray. And we can talk more about that in the conversation, like I said. But I was a little nervous about what Martha said about taking apart the sermon in the conversation. I'm like, But y'all have been merciful, and I'll remind you that that's this week's subject, if it gets... Well, the last thing I want to talk about is the very hardest person for most of us to extend mercy to, as if that last person wasn't difficult enough. That person is you. I think most of us judge ourselves with a far heavier rod than we judge others, even the most difficult of others. This beatitude, and all of them for that matter, is not meant for us to use as a club to beat ourselves over the head for falling short. It's meant to set us free, to walk in the way of Jesus. So please be gentle with yourself. We all struggle and have or perceive to have shortcomings. I entitled today's message, Mercy, Mercy Me, partly because Jeremy inspired me by taking the message title from last week from Bruce Springsteen, and I thought I'd just give a nod to Marvin Gaye while we're at it. The lyrics to that song are a bit depressing, calling out for mercy because our world is so terribly broken. It's very relevant for today. We are all broken in some way or fashion, and because we all are, our world is as well. But as we learned in a contemplative service some time ago, a broken object that is mended with love and gold can become truly more beautiful than it was originally. And so it is with us. I also mentioned at the beginning of this sermon that I thought our Beatitude of the Week was backwards. And as it seems to be a trend in this series, I would like to offer a rewording of it. Instead of blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy, I would like to suggest something else. Because that sounds like unless you're merciful, God will cut off his stream of mercy and you're doomed to the depths of the pit of hell. And when I was researching for this sermon, I actually found a sermon that said that. Good Lord. And then I realized with horror that I used to believe that. Like I said, I've softened over the years. Well, let's try this instead. Blessed are those who have received mercy, for they can in turn be merciful to others. Or this. Because of God's great mercy that he has lavished and lovingly poured out upon us, it is well for us, and we are in tune with God when we extend to mercy to those we encounter on our path. I'd like to invite the worship team forward. We live in a now and not yet. We have received mercy. We are receiving mercy. And we will continue to receive mercy from God who has an unending supply of it. And that allows us to live in hope. Hope that the broken in this world will be made whole. That mercy will indeed triumph over judgment. That love will indeed triumph over all. And that we can be a part of that. I wonder what it would be like if we were brave, just for a moment, and extended mercy to someone who needs it, whether they know it or not. What if we took that risk? What if that act of mercy became a catalyst, first a drop in a tidal wave of compassion? What if? Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Yesterday, today, always. Amen.